This is Icon Art Radio, and I'm Bill Teepel, and I'm here with my guest host, Alan Cobb. And today's guest is Randy Dillon. Randy came to Fairfield, let's go back to the history a little bit here. I first met you about a year ago, I suppose, and you were living in Virginia, and you had a home here, but you must have come and gone for some years.
That's correct. Several years, yes, since 2007.
And then you sold your place in Virginia and moved here full-time about 6 months or so ago?
About 6 months ago, that's right.
Okay. So I know you as an art collector, a lover of art, and you came with a already fine collection of art, of heirloom pieces of your families and newer pieces, some by some of the most famous artists in Washington, D.C. So you are an art collector to me. But how did you when did you first begin to collect art? Is there like a first piece that you bought that you can remember?
You know, collecting it starts with a connection to the art. And I think we all have it at some point. Everybody in the world sees something that they like or love and they say, ah. And probably that started with me, you know, one of those third grade field trips into the National Gallery of Art or something like that. And, you know, you go around, you look at all this stuff. But I'm pretty much convinced that I remember being delighted by Renoir's Girl with a Watering Can and spending all my money, you know, like $1.25 or something like that, and buying a print or the postcards. And, you know, the light and the flowers and the little girl there with the watering can and all that kind of stuff. It was just, you know, it's just something delightful. But as time, I think what there were several things that were probably kind of formative. When I was 10 or 11 years old, summer camp, I took a photography class. And I got second prize in the end of the class photography thing, although that wasn't the rewarding part, because I should have had first anyway. But the photo I took was on my parents' farm, the farm on which I grew up, and it was called Rainy Dawn at Full Cry. And I loved that image. I just loved that image. And why I loved it, I couldn't articulate then. I can't articulate today. It's the same experience I have with, you know, a lot of things. I can't articulate why. But I loved that image. And in the same photography class, we did things in the darkroom, like expose various objects to photographic paper. And I did this other thing that I still vividly remember as probably my first appreciation of abstract art. You know, these little objects on it and, you know, black and white, all that kind of stuff. It goes on, as I think Bill knows, I was an architecture major as an undergraduate, so had a fair amount of art and architecture history. Wonderful professor, excuse me, named Henry Millen, Hank Millen, later went on to be the director of the National Gallery sort of advanced institute or whatever it was, but he really taught us how to observe. And to observe in a kind of non-judgmental sort of way, to ask and ask and ask, what are you seeing? What are you seeing? What are you seeing? And to write about it or to do something or to go out. I remember going out and drawing this place on Beacon Hill called Primus Avenue and making several attempts at it. So I'm not as diligent or as observing as I was in Hank Millen's class. But, you know, my first sort of adult collections were this crazy woman from Alexandria whose work you've seen of the beautifully drafted, interestingly composed little hummingbird in the background of a porch and then a big thing with a Texaco sign, the Gulf sign. So you, anyway, that's really how it started, how I got involved in this great conversation that goes on for millennia about whatever it is we're talking about in the visual arts.
Well, I think that collecting art is just as much of a personal art form as making the painting in the boundaries of the canvas with paint. That you're drawing from your...
Well, I can tell you it's a lot easier than doing what you do, though. I mean, I could not do
Well,
what you
I don't
do,
know.
So.
I mean, you know, some realist painters say that, oh, anybody can do abstract art. Mm-hmm. It's, realistic painting is difficult. Mm-hmm. But then if they try to do abstract painting, they find out right away how that they make very good, bad paintings, that it's very difficult to compose. Because abstract art is all about composing in form and color, just as you would compose with sounds to make a symphony. And there is complex in terms of creating a unified composition. So in that light, I would say that putting a collection of works together that has unity and has meaning together and has visual, and it works visually in the architectural context is a serious art form. But it's also something that comes natural more for certain people than others, so that they might feel like they're not doing anything, they're just putting things on their wall. And I walk in and I am quite taken by how beautiful the choice of works is and their meaning to each other and in the context. And so it is an art form. And your home is dynamite. It's just a beautiful combination of all of these elements that I've just discussed. So you're doing a great job of art curating within your home.
No, anyway.
Sure. Let's find some investors. Oh, but it's beautiful what you've done in the short time you've been here. But now I also know that you have more works of art than you have wall space for them. And you kept telling me that you were going to just, you want to set it in this perfect organization and then leave it. But I continue to see you buying more works of art, and that is sort of the mark of the collector. There's the person who buys artworks to decorate their home or to make their home a nice living place with works of art on it. And I don't call them collectors, but I do call you a collector because I see that you're somewhat addicted to having to have something that moves you deeply.
Yeah.
So and that, this is just what it is. So relax into it. You are one.
Yeah. Well, you once used the word hoarder, and
somebody else used that word, and I remember saying, "There, yeah, that's right." But then afterwards, I went home after we had that conversation. I said, "No, that's the wrong word. It's just collectors."
Well, but you know, I don't mind the word hoarder because I can envision myself at some point in the future, 10 years down the road, when there's absolutely no more room in my house for anything. Just piling it all in the living room, getting in there with my arms around it and saying, "It's mine, it's all mine, it's all mine."
There you are.
So, but you know, what it's about to me is this conversation that goes on in my house between and among the stuff that's there. And It has to do with an historical kind of conversation. You know, I have portraits going back. One of my ancestors, late 1700s to the mid 1800s to, you know, I have all kinds of stuff, you know, that Raoul Dufy from the Sam Gilliams and, you know, your stuff. And so there's this conversation going on that is a reflection of kind of my experience of, you know, being lucky enough to be exposed to a lot of the periods of art and who did what and when, and knowing that, you know, golly, you know, how did we get from Leonardo's Annunciation, that beautiful little red-haired angel that I saw sitting on an easel in the Uffizi many years ago, to up to, you know, the Monets and Picasso, and then all of a sudden we're at Jackson Pollock.
Right.
And then all of a sudden we're at Andy Warhol and cans and Roy Lichtenstein and comic books. How does this happen? You know, there is this dialogue going on constantly about our history, and it's going on at a level that we cannot articulate. The thing that just fascinates me is that how is it that these things speak to us at some level to which we respond without our being able to consciously understand or articulate it? So in my house, there's a little bit of that dialogue going on. And as particularly as Bill knows, when it comes to smaller pieces, your own works, Ken Dubin's works, the Wes Mills drawings that I have in there, I think it's helpful to me in monitoring this conversation to have multiple pieces from the same artist, because that artist is talking to him or herself too about doing something new. Why is that? Is he rejecting something old? Is he, you know, what's going on? So having multiple pieces from the same artist is about that artist's conversation with himself, having, you know, your pieces with the beautiful lady from 1840, whatever, in the hall. There's a conversation going on with, you know, where we have been. And the delightful thing is that when it's in your own house, you get to direct the conversation, right, unlike in the rest of life when people are interrupting you.
Well, it's your gallery, and you're the curator.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So, but what I'm going to do is I continue, because since I've been here in Fairfield with all these wonderful artists, I've been acquiring at a pace that, yikes. So what am I going to do, you know, with all this stuff? Am I going to end up with a house that's like the Prado with, you know, paintings everywhere up and down the walls and crammed into, you know, closets and, you know, so anyway, but it's a lot of fun.
But that's a conversation you're having with yourself. And you could see one, and of course I'm a proponent for curating one's art through in the home, because you can't, you know, after a while you get to feel like, well, it's kind of been this way for a while. What would it be like to put that one next to that one?
Right.
And who, you know, you could even at one point just pack the walls with everything and have a salon for a while. Then back to minimalist three pieces on the walls. You know, you could, it's a play zone for you. I mean, it's an arena to express yourself through these things that you own, which has to do with a dialogue between you and those artists too. So it's a wonderful position, that of the curator, which I didn't realize till I fell into that myself, because I was more the artist teacher. And then I started hanging work in some empty rooms, and I became a curator, and I've learned all about this. But what's cool for me is that I have a familiarity with the entire loop, from the creation to the teaching what it is to be creative and how you produce the product, to how the product interfaces and interacts with the entire community through the curating. And it's so I'm lucky to have the entire arena to play with.
I think my experience in the theater is what accounts for my always thinking of any art as being part of an installation. You know, you put a painting on the wall, but it's on that wall in this room, and it's there on that wall, and so on. And to me, that context is so important and so, you know, hugely influential on how we see the thing that we've put on the wall. I mean, just putting a painting on the wall in a gallery obviously elevates it miles above a painting that's leaning against the wall in your garage. You know, same painting, but
well, right.
One of them is demanding to be taken seriously, and the other one is sort of suggesting that you should ignore it, or maybe throw it away.
I think Bill and I saw that, because from time to time I asked Bill to come over and help. Where do I move things? And I had Ken Dubin come over, and Marcia Hansen, and God only knows, lots of people. But I had this gigantic Sam Gilliam over my fireplace, and I think you and I both liked it there, and I liked it there. And then Ken Dubin came along and said, well, he had me change something about it. He said, it looks too crowded, but we couldn't figure out where to put it. So I just ran over and put it in my dining room, and all of a sudden, it just really changed that installation, that theatrical aspect of how you saw that Sam Gilliam. But you're right. It is an installation. I've never really thought about it.
Yeah.
My God, I've got like performance art going on there. Is that what it means?
Yeah. We got it all.
So I need weird music.
No, it's what is your installation about? That's it. You know, it includes your furniture and your carpets and the flooring and the paint on the wall.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and the music and the various. Well, have you gone to the theater or to the movies with one person, watched a movie, and then gone to see the same next to you? Then you've gone to the same movie again with another person. Just who you're with,
who's absolutely
in the room with you,
yeah,
affects how you see the mm-hmm. installation.
Mm. Anything that I create, I have to experience it with half a dozen other people before I have any idea what I've done. Hmm. If it's something I wrote, ideally I would like to read it aloud to, you know, at least two or three different people, because as I'm reading it, I'm picking up something from their comprehension of it, and I'm sort of hearing it through their ears, and I'm realizing, gosh, that thing I just said, they're not going to know what I'm talking about. I need to fix that.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with music. I play the music for someone who's classically trained and has a tremendous, you know, classical vocabulary and mm-hmm. and musicology and stuff. And I hear what I'm doing in terms of whether I'm just making a whole lot of naive, ugly movements or whether there's something potentially credible about it. And I listen to it with someone else who loves to listen to weird abstract sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think, oh, that is pretty cool. I like the way it goes off there and uh-huh. stuff. And it's not until I've heard it through other people's ears or eyes that it even begins to make sense to me.
I think it's the same thing is I think true of art, mm-hmm. because I will try very, very hard never to be condemnatory mm-hmm. of any form of art, because wherever you start, if you one of your points is how do you start being a collector, and you know it starts with whatever you like, because that thing, and we've previously used the example of those big round-eyed kids that were paintings of big round-eyed kids that
Keen.
Walter Keen with a little tear dripping down the big eye.
Exactly. Yeah. But those things have some meaning, some subliminal meaning to somebody.
Well, and actually to a lot of buddies
'50s. Yeah, exactly. It has some subliminal meaning to somebody. And so it's speaking to them. I think the question is, how broad is the conversation that person starts to participate in? Because there is a whole lot of visual stuff out there that is speaking in different dialects. You know, Ken Dubin, when he came over and started showing me some of his stuff, he would say, well, do you like this? Do you like this? Do you like this? And I said, Ken, it's not, whether I like it or not, isn't entirely relevant. Because the question is, I'll like it if I'm speaking the dialect that you are presenting in there. If you're presenting a dialect of Italian that I understand because of my history, because of what I've seen of all the visual arts, of the context that I've put all that I've seen into, I will probably respond to it. If you're speaking a dialect of Italian from, you know, Montalcino that I've never heard and it's weird, then, you know, I won't get it. And whose problem is that? You may be speaking the most beautiful dialect of Montalcino Italian that's ever been spoken, and I don't get it. So that's my problem, not yours. And so the people start where they start, and the question is, how many languages can they speak by the end of, you know, by the end of time? You've got, so luckily I've been exposed to, you know, a fair amount of languages, and intuitively, I don't know if I'm understanding what they're actually saying, but I respond to it because I've sort of got this context of, you know, what's out there, and it has some meaning to me.
But it's the same of two people speaking English and trying to have a conversation. Mm. Even they don't quite communicate all that well to each other. So it's this honing in on some kind of like a being in the same place at the same time, understanding the same thing mm-hmm. we can in this reality. And that goes on throughout. That way, art is able to kind of hit an even deeper, kind of more seed level, potential poetic conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And so we love that conversation. Mm-hmm. And we love to come from both sides, bringing as much knowledge of language and mm-hmm. perception to each other and to the dialogue. And if we both come wanting to get the most from the mm-hmm. other person, then we do, and we have as close of a communion as we can possibly have.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I think what happens when you see a piece of art is that the first impulse on the higher levels of of who you are, the first impulse is to look all the way inside to try and find where that came from.
Mm-hmm.
And that path from all the way inside, which is complete silence, complete fullness of emptiness, and contains nothing that you can recognize, that path out to the actual artwork outside of you that's the statement, in a sense. And so if you can, I mean, it means that, as you were saying about being non-judgmental and looking at a work of art and just seeing how it speaks to you, not whether it speaks the right way. In effect, you look at it and you immediately have to see the silence inside of yourself, even just for a moment, so that you can answer that question of what is this?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And of course, in many cases, there isn't any answer to what is this, because that's a verbal question.
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely.
The real answer to it is this. It mm-hmm. is what it is, and it doesn't mm-hmm. need to be defined.
Right.
And so many non-writing artists, you know, when asked, or even poets who are clearly writing, when asked, you know, what does it mean? They say, well, if I could just tell you what it means, I would have written what it means
instead of
that.
Yeah, that's great. You know, you look at the show at Icon right now, the two front windows, and Madeleine de Jolie's thing about searching for an answer, because people are always asking her, what does it mean? What does it mean? And the other window is this delightful, to me, fax machine of Jill Brown's, and it shows her interest in where did we come from, what's the context that we exist in. You know, she's got this modern implement, a fax machine, very utilitarian kind of thing, and it's spewing out all this gorgeous, I mean, just gorgeous, whatever it is up there with the Euclidean formulas and the documents that she's pulled off the internet, where she's clearly so exploring what is this history and context, you know, in which we live, or isn't it glorious, or, you know, it's, I just love the, you know, the juxtaposition of this modern utilitarian instrument spewing out this magical stuff. I wish my fax machine did that.
Yeah. So. That can be arranged.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just black and white in a fax machine.
Well, it's true. It's hard to get encaustic stuff through a fax machine. Yeah. It gums up the works.
And then you go inside and there's Madeline's little shoes. And, you know, just a little shoe sitting there with the little decorative thing in it. And you find wonder and delight in it. You know, it's just wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
So we sort of have fun talking about these things and analyzing them from design points of view and stuff, but those are just very partial little quips that we make about it, because the totality of the thing is way beyond anything that we could actually capture in any kind of words.
It is, but you know, when I listen to you, Bill, talk about a painting or something, and you talk about, the composition is good, and, you know, blah, 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 this, and all the things I don't really know very much about, but I am struck. What it leaves me with is admiration for the craft of being an artist. And for you, as you sometimes say, you've, over all these years, you've developed this craft and the technique, and Jill and Madeline and, you know, Ken Dubin, all these people have developed this craft and technique. And so you're able to, as you sometimes say, sort of go into the cave of this, you know, of this subtler world. And because you have these skills, you're able to bring it back out into a manifest world that I look at and I take it back inside somewhere, and it has a response in me. So it's this fascinating thing of being able to have the skill and craft and whatever it is that leads you into that cave.
And that's the role of the artist. And the more levels to a work of art. See, if somebody can be a great colorist, and that's it, they can be famous as a colorist, but levels of meaning, concept, craftsmanship, all of these things, the more levels a person commands, the greater and more richness, the wholeness is conveyed to the painting.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.